Hello, and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com, and often posted other places, too. This is going to be recording 34, Dalton translation of Mein Kampf. We're on Volume 2. We're going to do Chapter 14, and we're going to do the first half. We're going to do Sections 1 through 7, and then we'll leave 8 through 16 for next time. But again, he's been talking about foreign policy all through Chapter 13, and now Chapter 14, again, Volume 2, is Germany's policy in Eastern Europe. Again, we'll do 14.1 through 14.7, about average length. Two considerations, says Adolf Hitler, induce me to make a special analysis of Germany's relationship to Russia. First, this may prove to be the most decisive concern of Germany's foreign policy, and two, this problem is also a touchstone for the political capacity of the young National Socialist movement as to clear thinking and correct action. Clear thinking and correct action. 14.1, prejudice in questions of foreign policy. I must confess that the second point has sometimes been a great source of anxiety to me. The members of our movement are not recruited from those who are indifferent, but rather mostly from among those with very extreme worldviews. It's only natural that their understanding of foreign politics should suffer from prejudice and inadequate knowledge due to the political and philosophical ties of those circles to which they were formerly attached. And this isn't true merely of those who come to us from the left. On the contrary, however harmful their previous teaching may have been about such problems, in many cases this was at least partly balanced by a residue of sound and natural instincts. Then it was only necessary to substitute a better teaching in place of the earlier influences, and the instinct of self-preservation could be considered as the best ally. On the other hand, it's much harder to impress clear political ideas on men whose earlier political education was no less nonsensical and illogical. They sacrificed the last residue of their natural instincts on the altar of objectivity. It's particularly difficult to compel these representatives of our so-called intelligentsia to take a clear and logical view of their own interests and those of their nation. They are burdened with a dead weight of prejudice and senseless conceptions, and worst of all, they have renounced or lost every instinct of self-preservation. The National Socialist movement has to fight a hard battle with these people because, despite total incompetence, they are so self-conceited that, without the slightest justification, they look down with disdain on ordinary and healthier people. These arrogant know-it-alls are wholly incapable of calm analysis and consideration, which are the necessary preliminaries of any will or action in foreign politics. It is these very circles that are beginning today to divert our foreign policy toward most disastrous directions and turn it away from any real defense of the focused interests of our people. Instead, they serve their own fantastic ideologies, and I thus feel myself obliged to offer to my own colleagues a clear exposition of the most important problem in foreign policy, namely our relation to Russia. Most important problem in foreign policy is our relation to Russia. I'll deal with it as thoroughly as necessary to make it generally understood, as far as possible in a work such as this. Let me begin with the following remarks. By foreign policy, we understand to be the managing of a nation's affairs and its relations with the rest of the world, based on certain definite facts. Moreover, as National Socialists, we must lay down the following principle regarding the nature of the foreign policy of a focused state. A focused state's foreign policy must, first of all, bear in mind the duty of securing the existence of the race on this planet, which is embodied in this state. And this is done by establishing a healthy and natural relation between the number and growth of the population on the one hand, and the quantity and quality of the soil on the other. So, the relation between the population and the soil. 14.2. Significance of the state's area. The only healthy condition is one that assures a people's sustenance on their own soil. Any other situation is unhealthy even though it may endure for centuries or even thousands of years. Sooner or later, this will lead to the decline or even the destruction of the people concerned. Only a sufficiently large space on this earth can assure a people's free existence. The necessary extent of territorial expansion for settlement must not be estimated by present requirements, nor even by the magnitude of its agricultural productivity in relation to the population. In the first volume, under the heading Germany's Alliance Policy Before the War, I have already explained that a state's land area is of importance, not only as the source of the nation's food, but also militarily and politically. Footnote 199, an apparent reference to Chapter 4, see in particular Sections 4.2 and 4.3. Once a people is assured of its sustenance by the amount of soil, it must consider how to defend it. This depends on the state's power political strength, hyphenated, power political, which in turn depends on the military geographical possibilities, also hyphenated, military geographical. Thus, the German nation can assure its own future only as a world power. For nearly 2,000 years, the defense of our national interests was a matter of world history, as can be seen from our more or less successful activities in the field of foreign politics. We ourselves have been witnesses to this. The gigantic struggle of nations from 1914 to 1918 was only the struggle of the German people for their existence on this globe, but we designated this type of event as a world war. And he's saying it was only the struggle of the German people for their existence was World War I. Germany entered this struggle as a presumed world power. I say presumed because in reality it was no such thing. In 1914, if there had been a different relation between our area and population, Germany really would have been a world power, and, aside from other factors, the war would have ended in our favor. It's neither my task nor my intention here to discuss what would have happened if in case the but did not exist. But I feel it absolutely necessary to show the present conditions in their bare and unadorned reality, pointing out the weakness inherent in them, so that, at least in the ranks of the National Socialist movement, they should receive the necessary insight. Moving on to page 693. Germany today is no world power. Even if our present military weakness could be overcome, we would still have no claim to this title. What importance does a state have on this planet in which the relation of the population to area is so miserable as in the present German Reich? In an era in which the world is being gradually divided among states, many of whom almost embrace whole continents, one cannot speak of a world power in the case of a structure whose political motherland is confined to the laughable area of barely 500,000 square kilometers. Footnote 200 reads, for reference, the area of present-day Germany is around 357,000 square kilometers. If we include Austria, the total comes up to 441,000 square kilometers, so it's even smaller than in Hitler's time. 14.3, French and German colonial policy. From a purely territorial point of view, the area of the German Reich is vanishingly small compared with other so-called world powers. England mustn't be cited as proof to the contrary, for the English motherland is in reality the great capital of the British World Empire, which owns almost a fourth of the Earth's surface. Furthermore, we must consider the American Union as foremost among the colossal states, also Russia and China. Some of these spatial areas are more than 10 times greater than the present German Reich. Again, too big for Europe, too small for the world, is this saying about Germany. And France itself must also be ranked among these states. Not only is it adding to its army strength in a constantly increasing measure by recruiting colored people from its gigantic empire, but also racially, its niggerization is progressing such that one can now actually speak of the creation of an African state on European soil. And he said this in the 1920s. France's present-day colonial policy cannot be compared with that of Germany in the past. If France continues to develop in the present manner for the next 300 years, all traces of French blood will finally be submerged in the growing Euro-African mulatto state. This would be a formidable self-contained settlement area from the Rhine to the Congo, filled with an inferior race that gradually emerged through a process of continuous bastardization. This distinguishes French colonial policy from the old German one. The former German colonial policy, like everything, was carried out halfway. It neither increased the settlement area of the German race, nor did it attempt, as criminal as it would have been, to strengthen the Reich through the use of black blood. The Askari in German East Africa represented a small and hesitant step along this road, but in reality they served only for the defense of the colonies themselves. The idea of importing black troops into a European battlefield, entirely aside from its practical impossibility in a world war, was never entertained as a proposal to be realized under better circumstances, whereas, on the contrary, the French always looked upon this as fundamental to their colonial activities, using black troops. And we've heard him talk before about the Jews' plan to bastardize whites out of existence in Europe and the use of Francophone black troops in the Ruhr occupation by the French of the Germans. The French always looked upon this, I guess this use of black troops from Africa, as fundamental, whereas Germans never even considered it. Thus, the world today has not only a number of states that are much greater than our German nation in population, but they also have a land area that is, above all, the basis of their political power. Never has the relation between area and population in the German Reich been as unfavorable relative to other world states as at the beginning of our history 2,000 years ago, and again today. Formerly, we were a young people storming into a world of crumbling great states whose last giant, Rome, we helped to bring down. Today we find ourselves in a world of great power states in which our own Reich is constantly sinking into insignificance. 14.4. The historical mission of National Socialism. We must always face this bitter truth clearly and calmly. We must study the population and area of the German Reich in relation to other states and compare them down through the centuries. I know that everyone will then come to the same sad conclusion that I did at the start. Germany is no longer a world power, regardless of whether its military strength is strong or weak. There's no comparison between us and the other great states on earth, thanks to the wholly catastrophic leadership of our people in foreign policy, to our lack of, I should almost say, a testamentary goal in foreign policy, and to the loss of every sound impulse and instinct for self-preservation. If the National Socialist movement wants to be recognized by history as having a great mission for our people, it will have to painfully recognize the real truth of our situation in the world. It must courageously fight against the aimlessness and incompetence that has hitherto guided our German nation in foreign policy. Then, without respect for tradition or preconceptions, it must find the courage to organize our national forces and set them on a path that will lead them away from the present restricted living space and toward new land and soil. Thus will the movement save us from the danger of perishing from this earth or of serving others as a slave nation. The National Socialist movement must seek to abolish the present disproportion between our population and land area, considering the latter as a source of our sustenance and as a basis of political power. And thus it must abolish the contrast between past history and the hopelessness of our present impotence. In doing so, it must bear in mind the fact that we are members of the highest humanity on this earth, that we have a correspondingly high duty, and that we will fulfill this duty only if we inspire the German people with a racial sensitivity so that they will not only breed good dogs, horses, and cats, but will also care for their own blood. We have a correspondingly high duty, the fulfillment of which means that we will make the German people racially sensitive to the need to breed not only good dogs, horses, and cats, but also good people. 14.5, enduring fruits of a millennial policy. I guess that would mean for 1,000 years, millennium. Let's see here. enduring fruits of a millennial policy, 14.5, we're on the bottom of page 695. When I say the German foreign policy until now has been aimless and ineffectual, the proof of my statement is found in the actual failures of this policy. If our people were intellectually inferior or cowardly, the final results of their struggle on this earth couldn't have been worse than what we see today. What happened during the last decades before the war should not deceive us. We must not measure a Reich's strength taken by itself, but only in comparison with other states. Such a comparison shows that the other states increased their strength such that they not only were equivalent, but ultimately became greater, so that contrary to the apparent rise, Germany's true path diverged more and more from other states and fell behind. In short, there was a large margin in our disfavor. Indeed, even our population remained far behind and lost ground. Though it's true that our people's heroism is unsurpassed by that of any other nation on earth, yes, that they poured out more blood than any other nation on earth in defense of their existence, their failure was due only to the erroneous manner in which it was applied. In this connection, if we examine the political experiences of our people during more than 1,000 years, recalling the innumerable wars and struggles, and scrutinizing it all in light of the present results, we must confess that this sea of blood has produced only 3 phenomena that we may consider as lasting fruits of specific actions in foreign policy and overall politics. Sea of blood has produced only 3 phenomena. Here they are. 1, the colonization of the Ostmark, mostly by Bavarians. 2, the conquest and settlement of the territory east of the Elbe. 3, the organization of the Brandenburg-Prussian state by the Hohenzollerns, which became the model for the crystallization of a new Reich. An instructive warning for the future. Those are their only 3 achievements, he's saying. The first 2 of these great foreign policy successes have remained the most enduring. Without them, our people would play no role today. These were the first, and unfortunately the only, successful attempts to establish a harmony between our increasing population and the quantity of land and soil. And we must look upon it as truly disastrous that our German historians have never correctly appreciated these 2 achievements, which were so full of importance for the future generations. By contrast, they praised many other things, fantastic heroism, innumerable adventures and wars, but without understanding how insignificant these were for the main line of our national development. The 3rd great success achieved by our political activity was the establishment of the Prussian state and the development of a particular state concept. This also resulted in the German army's instinct of self-preservation and self-defense, which was suited to the modern world. The transformation of the idea of individual self-defense into the duty of national defense is derived from every state structure and state conception. See, whites need something to defend themselves, and that's exactly what is denied to us, what we're oppressed from, and what we're not simply seizing and taking like we need to. So we exist to be eaten, the butt bearing the burden. We're joked about, we're made fun of, we're taxed, we're effectively enslaved, demoralized, and we have to break out of that by realizing our actual community is racial, it's not religious or anything else, and defending ourselves in that way. This is what he's saying. The significance of this development cannot be overestimated, that Brandenburg-Prussia was the right way in the modern world for a state to be formed and defend itself. Disrupted by excessive individualism, the German people became disciplined under the organization of the Prussian army, and in this way recovered at least some of their long-lost organizational capacity. What other people still authentically possess as a herd society, we at least partially recovered for our national society through military training. Consequently, the abolition of universal compulsory military service, which may have no meaning for dozens of other nations, had fatal consequences for us. 10 generations of Germans without corrective and educational military training, leaving us to the evil effects of racial and hence philosophical division, and our people would lose the last remnant of an independent existence on this planet, and that's what they're trying to work out right now. He says, if you take 10 generations of Germans who aren't trained militarily, and you will lose our existence. The German spirit could then make its contribution to civilization only through individuals living under the rule of foreign nations, and their origin would remain unknown, mere cultural fertilizer until the last residue of Aryan Nordic blood became corrupted or extinguished. It's remarkable that the real political successes, again, he said all great civilizations of the past died due to blood poisoning, and that's what he's saying that our enemies are trying to do, so that there's no collective for whites. That's an illegitimate collective, and the church backs them up on that. See, that's the key thing to see, that this thing you think is good is just the good cop in a good cop, bad cop routine played by Jews and Christians. It's remarkable that the real political successes achieved by our people during their millennial struggles are better appreciated and understood by our adversaries than ourselves. Even today, we still grow enthusiastic about a heroism that robbed our people of millions of their best blood, but turned out to be completely fruitless. He means all the ones who died in World War I. Millions of people actually died. Great people, not scummy Jews who died fake deaths in camps. They were made to work a little bit in between swimming and volleyball. The distinction between our people's real political successes and the futile ends for which our national blood was shed is of supreme importance for our present and future conduct. We National Socialists must never join in the common hurrah patriotism of the contemporary bourgeois world. It would be a mortal danger for us to look upon immediate pre-war developments as constituting even the slightest obligation in our path forward. From the entire historical period of the 19th century, we do not accept a single obligation that was based in that period itself. In contrast to the policy of those who represented that period, we must take our stand on the highest viewpoint regarding all foreign policy, namely to bring the land into harmony with our population. Indeed, from the past, we can only learn that the aim of our political conduct must lie in two directions. One, land and soil, as the objective of our foreign policy. One, land and soil as the objective of our foreign policy. Land and soil. One, our foreign policy must get us land and soil. This would be the Lebensraum. Two, a new philosophically established uniform foundation as the goal of domestic political activity. We're united on the basis of being Germans or on the basis of race, as it would be in America. 14.6, a call for the old borders. A call for the old borders. I still want to briefly take a stand on the question of how far our territorial aims are ethically and morally justified. This is necessary because, unfortunately, in our so-called folkish circles, there are all kinds of plausible big mouths who try to persuade the German people that the aim of their foreign policy ought to be to right the wrongs of 1918, while at the same time they find it necessary to assure the whole world of folkish brotherhood and sympathy. In regard to this point, I want to make the following statement. To demand the restoration of the 1914 borders is a political absurdity that's fraught with such consequences as appear to be criminal. The 1914 Reich borders were anything but logical. They were not really complete, in the sense of including all the members of the German nation, nor were they reasonable in light of military geographical effectiveness. They were not the result of a well-considered political plan, but were temporary borders established in virtue of an unfinished political struggle, and indeed they were partly the result of chance. One could, with equal and in many cases better right, choose some other representative year in German history and demand that our foreign policy goal should be the restoration of those conditions. Such demands are quite characteristic of our bourgeois world, who in such matters take no political thought of the future, but live only in the past, and indeed only in the immediate past. Even their retrospection doesn't go back beyond their own times. The law of inertia binds them to the present order of things, leading them to oppose every attempt to change this, but without crossing over into any kind of active defense beyond mere stubbornness. It's obvious that the political horizon of such people doesn't reach beyond the year 1914. In proclaiming the aim of their political activities to restore those borders, they only help to repair the rifts in our League of Enemies. Only this can explain the fact that, 8 years after a world struggle among states with widely varying wishes and goals, the coalition of victors still remains more or less intact. Each of these states benefited from the German collapse at some time or another. Fear of our strength caused the great powers to stay silent about their greed and envy towards one another. They felt that the best guarantee against a future resurgence would be to dismember as much of the Reich as possible. A bad conscience and fear of our people's strength is the durable cement that has held the members of that league together, even today. And we don't disappoint them. By setting up the restoration of the 1914 borders as the aim of Germany's political program, each member of the enemy coalition, who might otherwise be inclined to withdraw from the League, fears that he might be attacked by us if isolated, thus losing support of his allies. Each individual state feels itself targeted and threatened by this slogan. This is absurd for the following two reasons. One, the means of power are lacking to draw it from the evening air into reality. And two, even if it really could be carried out, the result would be so miserable that, by God, it wouldn't be worthwhile to risk our people's blood for it. There can scarcely be any doubt whatsoever that only through bloodshed could we restore the 1914 borders. Only a childlike mind believes that the Versailles Treaty can be corrected by indirect means or begging. This is aside from the fact that any such attempt would require a man of Talleyrand's character, which we don't have. Footnote 201, Charles Maurice de Talleyrand Perigord, 1754 to 1838, was a French diplomat, Talleyrand, and politician, including under Napoleon. He was known for his cynical and crafty but effective diplomacy. "We have no Talleyrand," says Hitler. "Half our politicians consist of characterless shysters who are quite hostile to our people, while the other half is made up of well-meaning, harmless, and easygoing softheads." "Times have changed since the Congress of Vienna," footnote 202, held in 1814 to 1815. "Times have changed since 1814-1815's Congress of Vienna. It's no longer princes or their courtesans who contend and bargain about state borders, but rather the inexorable world Jew, hyphenated, who fights for his dominion over nations. No nation can remove this fist from its throat, except by the sword. Only an organized and concentrated national sentiment can turn into it. Only an organized and concentrated national sentiment, turned into an effective force, can defy the international enslavement of peoples. The path is and remains a bloody one." His essay doesn't say we're going to change the culture by writing essays. He frankly says we must fight. Organization, sentiment, strong feeling, and fighting is what will remove the Jew's fist from our throat. Absolutely straightforward, absolutely correct. If we are convinced that the German future calls for the highest sacrifice in one way or another, then we must set aside considerations of political expediency, establish a worthy goal, and fight for it. The 1914 borders are of no significance for the German future. They neither serve to protect us in the past, nor do they offer any strength for the future. With these borders, the German people cannot attain an inner unity, nor can they assure their sustenance, nor, from a military viewpoint, are they advantageous, nor can they improve our relations with the other world powers, or better, with the real world powers. We won't narrow the gap with England, and we won't achieve the size of the American Union. Indeed, not even France would be diminished in terms of world political importance. Only one thing is certain. The attempt to restore the 1914 borders, even if successful, would demand so much of our people's blood that no further sacrifice would be possible for such measures needed to really secure the life and future of the nation, which he said before lies to the east. They need more land to grow and spread on. Their people are too cramped, too numerous. On the contrary, intoxicated by such a superficial success, further aims would be renounced, all the more so because the national honor would seem to be repaired and new doors would be opened, at least for the moment, to commercial development. 14:7. This will be the last we'll do today, which is no sentimentality in foreign policy. Against all this, we National Socialists must stick firmly to our foreign policy goal, namely that the German people must be assured of the land and soil entitled to it on this earth. And only this action, before God and our German posterity, would justify any sacrifice of blood. Before God, because we are sent into this world with a mission to struggle for our daily bread, as creatures to whom nothing is given, and who must be able to win and defend their position as lords of the earth only through their own intelligence and courage, and before German posterity, insofar as that for each one who has shed his blood, 1,000 others will be bequeathed to posterity. The land on which our German peasants will one day be able to bring forth their sturdy sons justifies the investment of our sons today. And even though the responsible statesmen may be persecuted by their contemporaries, posterity will absolve them from all blood guilt for the sacrifice of their people. Here I must offer the sharpest protest against those folkish pencil pushers who pretend that such territorial extension would be a violation of sacred human rights and attack it as such. One never knows who stands behind such persons, but it's certain that the confusion they provoke is desirable and convenient for the enemies of our nation. By taking such an attitude, they help to internally weaken and destroy the will of our people to promote, in the only effective way, their own vital interests. No nation on earth possesses even a square meter of land by decree of a higher will or a higher right. Just as Germany's borders are the outcome of chance, and are only temporary ones that were established by political struggles at various times, so too are the borders of other nations' living space. And just as only an imbecile could look upon the Earth's geography as unchangeable as granite, which in reality represents a definite stage in a given development, created by the mighty forces of nature, and which may be altered tomorrow by greater forces of destruction and change, so too the borders of living spaces in the lives of nations. So things change all the time, and we got to look out for our own interests. This is rough. Again, the key here is he looks to nature to understand what's going on. He doesn't look to any kind of God, or he may use God. In my opinion, he's basically using it rhetorically. I don't think so much he believes in. He's using that as a figure for wherever all this came from, whether it's natural or whether someone really did create it out of nothing. I don't know what he actually believed. I know what I think he believed. Anyway, in any case, it's still the same. He looks to nature for the rules, whereas the Christian would look against it because the Christian stuff comes from Jews. So they're not wanting you to get the right principles to live by. State borders are made by man and can be changed by man. And we've seen that in the U.S. these last few years as they take down monuments and they rename things. And we've seen that in South Africa and in other white nations, New Zealand. State borders are made by man and can be changed by man. The fact that a nation has acquired an enormous area is no reason why it should hold it forever. At most, it proves the strength of the conqueror and the weakness of the defeated. And in this strength alone lies the right. If the German people are imprisoned within an impossible area and face a miserable future, this is not by the command of fate, any more than to oppose such affairs is to disobey it. Just as no higher power has promised more territory to other nations than to the German, so it cannot be blamed for an unjust distribution of soil. Just as the soil on which we now live was not bestowed by heaven on our forefathers, but had to be conquered by mortal risk, so too in the future our people will not obtain territory, and thus life, as a favor from above, but must win it by the power of a triumphant sword. Today we're all convinced of the need to reckon with France, but this would be broadly ineffective if it were the sole aim of our foreign policy. It can and will have significance only if it serves as a rear cover in the struggle for an enlargement of our people's living space in Europe. Colonial acquisitions won't solve that problem. This will happen only by the winning of settlement territory for our people, such as will extend the area of the motherland, and thereby not only keep the new settlers in the closest communion with the land of their origin, but will guarantee to this region the advantages that arise from a unified expanse. So he's looking to the east for fresh grounds. I think he probably felt that France was France already had something pretty good going on, and it already had itself a whole lot of people in it. So it's not the optimal place. There's multiple reasons that that direction really doesn't work so well as to the east. Also physical reasons, geographical reasons. The Folkish movement mustn't be an advocate for other nations, but rather a protagonist for itself. Otherwise, it would be superfluous and, above all, would have no right to clamor about the past, for then it would be acting the same as before. The old German policy was unjustly determined by dynastic considerations, and future policy mustn't follow the sentimentality of cosmopolitan Folkishness. We must especially not be security police for the well-known so-called poor, small nations, but rather soldiers of ourselves. We National Socialists go still further. The right to land and soil becomes a duty when a great nation seems destined to go under unless its land is extended, and that's particularly true when the nation is not some little group of Negroes, but the Germanic mother of all life, which has given cultural shape to the modern world. Germany will either be a world power or not at all. But in order to become a world power, it needs that size which gives it the necessary importance today and gives life to its citizens. That's where we'll leave it today. We're midway through chapter 14. So you have a pretty clear idea of what he means and what he thinks. And that's a very famous line that's been quoted. Germany will either be a world power or not at all. And it's headed toward not at all right now. But there's still enough Germanic people around. If we can achieve enough understanding and we can come together and fight, we can indeed make the Aryans the force of forces in the world, the dominant people, as we should be. But God doesn't care if we go extinct. Nature doesn't care if we go extinct. There's nothing out there but our, as he said, intelligence and courage to make whatever we can happen. So with that, I'll leave you. I've been Alex Linder reading to you out of Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf, the Thomas Dalton translation. This has been recording, I think, number 34. And thanks for being with me, and I'll be back with you again for more real soon.